In this podcast, produced by the Hampshire and White Trust of Maritime Archaeology, we explore the Second World War and the changes and differences that we see today on the topics of food, pay, and holiday and leave. This podcast also looks at the events of D-Day and how they affected both the topics mentioned and people's everyday lives. D-Day was a phrase used for the invasion of Normandy. D-Day was the 6th of June 1944. The name Operation Overlord was also given to the event. Here is an account from Joy Mills, part of the Dive Under Victory project, about her experiences of D-Day.
You know, when there was the invasion, when we invaded France, a lot of the landing craft and the troops and all that went from Hardway as well as Stokes Bay, and they brought the first load of wounded came into Hardway because the road was full of ambulances. Priory Road was full of ambulances, and they brought all the wounded through. So some of them went to Haslow. The landing craft came in, and of course the landing craft came into Hardway as well because they built the slipways there, and all the roads around here was full of tanks, lorries, troop carried, everything. And they were sort of loading up the whole time as one lot came in and went out, and there was another lot waiting to come in, and they were all shipped straight out to France. And they brought the prisoners in here as well. They brought them in, and you're not going to believe it, but they came down through Grove Road singing, and they marched down through there. There was a field in Sandigo Road. Well, it was a little farm in Sandigo Road, and the field was taken over, and that was made into a transit camp for the prisoners.
Oh, right.
And, of course, they were all stripping off, having washes and that, and they had to put sacking all up.
Next, I interviewed Eileen Sparrow to hear her experiences of D-Day.
My experiences of D-Day. I joined the army, the Women's Royal Auxiliary Corps, in 1941, and I was a shorthand typist. At the time of D-Day, I was working with the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers. The build-up to D-Day was something which we'd all been hoping for because we wanted the war to be over shortly. Just before D-Day, a few weeks before D-Day, I had lots of extra work to do because the men of the unit went out daily to examine and look after the vehicles which were going to be used for D-Day. And they would come back in the afternoon with reams of lists of the things that had happened to that they had done, like getting the engines in perfect order, waterproofing them, and so on. All these details I had to type on several sheets of paper headed Overlord. I didn't know what Overlord meant, but I knew it was going to be something big, or maybe just an exercise. And D-Day itself, the first thing I can remember was girls dancing outside, because they just heard on the 6 o'clock news that D-Day had started. The rest of the day, I'm still typing Overlord papers and went on doing that for some time. I think we had, as far as I can remember, we had a church service about the invasion. And the rest of the day we spent trying to find out news from the radio. There wasn't a great deal because there wasn't much to say. And, of course, they didn't tell you the bad news, only the good news.
What were people's views on D-Day? Were they glad it was happening, or were they quite anxious?
I think both. I think people were relieved at last something was happening, that the war might soon be over. But, of course, there was a lot of anxiety, because we didn't know how it was going. It was such a huge operation, and there was so much to lose. And so it was constant anxiety. Listening to radio broadcasts, not knowing if we were getting the whole truth about the things that were happening. So when any advance was made, it was a great uplifting. People felt much happier, and perhaps then there would be setbacks after D-Day. A lot of them, lives were lost, so on. But eventually, it worked out.
I would say there's quite a big difference between the amount of leave you get now and the amount you got during World War II. This next clip is Bill Collins, part of the Dive Under Victory project, talking about how the lack of leave affected him and his family.
My daughter was 9 months old before I knew she'd been born. By the time I got the letter, she was 9 months old. First time I saw her, she was about 14 months old. But the lad's birthday, I was on the ship going out to Far East, and the troop carrier was going out. It was going out east then to Bombay, and I was on that when he was 1 year old, his first birthday.
Next is an interview from Eileen Sparrow talking about the amount of leave she got when she was working in the Women's Army.
In the weeks before D-Day, leave was restricted to within a certain mileage, and I think it was shortened as far as I can remember, because there was very little travel. The trains were kept busy with moving troops and so on, and equipment. And so we didn't get very far. We're not allowed to go very far. And my pay, because I was a non-commissioned officer, was, I think, by the end of the war, was about 27 shillings a week.
Like now, during World War II, there are many factors that affected pay. During World War II, the government had to fund the army to make sure that the war could be won. Does this mean that the amount people were paid wasn't always fair? Here is Jerry Norris, part of the Dive Onto Victory project, talking about the amount he got paid when he was a boy sailor during the war.
The mast was, all the rigging was covered, invariably covered in icicles, because mast class always took part, you had to take part first thing in the morning, prior to any other classes. And it was extremely hazardous getting up the mast, over the devil's elbow, up to the top, and back down again. And the last three, invariably, from each batch that went over, had to go round again. You were timed. So it was all a bit hairy. Mind you, we were well paid. We got half a crown a week, 2 and 6 a week. There was money that went into credits, because you had to buy your own kit. If you mistreated any item of kit, you were marched over to what we called the slops, the storeroom. You had to purchase this item, and the money was taken out of your credits. There were a couple of things that enhanced one's salary, if you can call it that. If you became a member of the bugle band, and you became what we call a sea bugler, you got an extra 6 months a week. I thought that was jolly good, and I did it, and got me extra tanner. With regard to food, we had to collect the food from the galley. It was quite reasonable, but you were always hungry. You were so hungry all the time, because everything was done at a double.
Think about the food that you can get at your supermarket. You can get fresh fruit and vegetables, even those that are grown in different countries. It was very different in World War II. More exotic foods from other countries couldn't be shipped over, and rationing meant that large families were usually quite hungry. This interview from Bill Collins is his own account of the availability of food when he was in the Navy.
You were given a mess allowance in those days, and you made your own food. You bought your own food, what you wanted, and you had a duty PO, took it in turns to take it, who did the messing, all depended on which you wanted. If you was going at sea for a long time, he just made do and made ready. But when he went into harbour and got refurnished, then he had different causes.
Next is an interview with Eileen Sparrow about the food that was available for her and how she and others coped with rationing.
I think in the army we had better food, possibly, than the civilians. But of course, because we were women, we only got 2/3 of the food, the rations that the men had. So I don't know how they worked out 2/3 of an egg, but that's how it happened. It was very monotonous. It was filling. there was enough of it, but very little variety. Most foods were rationed. Meat was on at one time reduced to 8 pence worth of meat per head, which seems ridiculous now, but didn't leave a lot of meat. There were some things which were not rationed. I think fresh fruit, local fruit. But of course, we had nothing like oranges and bananas and things like that during the war, because they were not shipped over. Rations, yes, were tight. And very little sugar, sweets, things like that. And so diet was quite boring, but I believe quite healthy in the long run. I was in the army, and so we were quite well fed. And I have nothing to complain about, but I think a lot of people did go hungry, especially those with large appetites, and who didn't grow vegetables and fruit in their gardens. A lot of places were taken, parks and places like that, quite a lot of them were taken over for growing vegetables.
What was the kind of majority view about rationing?
Well, I think people were bored with it, but they just got on. They knew it was inevitable, and odd things like that. People would queue outside a shop if something was coming in, something extra that wasn't on a ration. And you didn't let people, they didn't know, well, they were queuing for half the time, just hoping to get something. Clothes were rationed. You had clothing coupons. But as I was in the army, I didn't have clothing coupons. So I had to make do with pre-war clothing or have cut-downs of my mother's made for me and so on when I was on leave.
Making this podcast and taking interviews has been a good experience for me, as I didn't know much about D-Day before. But doing interviews on it has definitely improved my knowledge on this subject. If you want to know more about D-Day, then why not visit the D-Day Museum in Southsea, Portsmouth. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. To find out more and download other podcasts, go to www.hwtma.org.uk, where you can also check out the latest projects from the Hampshire and Wight Trust for Maritime Archaeology. This podcast was researched, compiled and presented by Clio for the Hampshire and Wight Trust for Maritime Archaeology. Thanks for listening.